Good morning. My name is Bliss Baker, and I'm the head of the Global Renewable Fuels Alliance. I want to invite our panelists up on stage. I won't introduce them, but I'll give them an opportunity to introduce themselves in a minute. The Global Renewable Fuels Alliance was started 4 or 5 years ago by Bob Dineen, Rob Verhoot, myself, and a couple others who aren't here today. And we created this organization in large part to respond to a lot of the attention we were getting in 2008 around issues like food for fuel, et cetera, and some of the international organizations like the UN, FAO, the World Bank, were starting to take an interest in our industry and making comments and producing reports, et cetera, on our industry, much of it was ill-informed and simply wrong. So we felt we had to create a bit of a platform in the international arena to respond to some of this commentary. And so we've set up a federation of industry associations, and many of the members are here on stage with us today. The GRFA aggressively responds and challenges the international organizations on some of their commentary. And, you know, I'm happy to say that over the last couple of years, their criticism has been somewhat muted. It's not perfect yet, but some of our activity is having an impact on them. In the case of the UN FAO, I think there's a glimmer of hope there, and some within the FAO now see biofuels as a real opportunity for developing countries to reduce their reliance on imported fossil fuels, but also boost investment in agriculture. And we're currently working with the UN FAO to try and bring some transparency to the impacts of crude oil prices on food prices. We hope to convince the FAO what we here already know, which is oil prices have a huge impact on food prices and are probably the single biggest contributor to food price spikes when crude oil prices spike. So that's the kind of activity that we're engaged in at the international arena. So we're going to raise the level of discussion here to the 50,000-foot level from our previous presenters and talk about some of the very pressing issues, the big pressing issues that are facing our industry from a public policy perspective and from a market perspective, and talk about some of those issues that all of these gentlemen face on a daily basis. We have on our stage today representatives who speak for probably 90% of the global biofuels production here, so we have a great deal of experience on the stage. And why don't we, to kick things off, maybe give everyone an opportunity to introduce themselves, explain what their role is, and then maybe give us a minute or two on what your very pressing issues are in your various jurisdictions. We have India represented here, Canada, Brazil, United States, and Europe. So maybe we'll kick it off with you, Bob, if you want to just introduce yourself. I'm not sure you need an introduction, but introduce yourself and maybe give us some insight into what your big issues you're dealing with today.
Well, indeed, I'm Bob Dineen with the Renewable Fuels Association. I represent an industry that is today the low-cost ethanol producer in the globe. We're very happy about that. We are focused on growing the marketplace for renewable fuels everywhere. We're also committed to, as I indicated earlier this morning, tearing down those barriers to trade that we find unnecessary, counterproductive, illegal, and we hope to build through this process a larger market for all of us. Go ahead.
Rob.
I'm right here.
Is my mic working?
Yep. Start whining.
They're waiting.
Mr. Verhoeven, you're up. You get a chance to respond.
Rob,
to Bob's infomercial.
There was an oil industry guy who spoke this morning safely. I'm sure you'll do fine.
Okay. Well, sit next to Bob. Good morning. My name is Rob Fierro. I'm representing the European producer of ethanol, just ethanol. We represent around 90% of the market in 16 countries. So that makes us truly international. We indeed try to create markets, which is difficult right now. I think we are facing the same fights as Bob is facing here in the United States. We have lost trust in our regulators, and that's a very, very big concern to us. We are indeed for fair trade. That's all I'm going to say for now.
Yeah, we'll get into that. We'll get into that issue in a few minutes.
Good morning. I'm Jayan Godbole. I represent Praj Industries Limited of India. Although we are a company from India, we are a company with global footprint. We have supplied more than 600 ethanol plants in more than 60 countries. So we are essentially a technology, engineering, and equipment company. We have developed our own cellulosic technology, and we are putting up a demo plant in India, which can use sugarcane bagasse as well as corn store and corn cobs. I don't represent just India. If given a chance, I can also talk a little bit about Asia, Southeast Asia, and also about South America. So I'm here to support ethanol, and we like ethanol.
My name is Scott Thurlow. I'm the president of the Canadian Renewable Fuels Association. We represent the interests of the ethanol industry as well as the renewable diesel industry in Canada, as well as the feedstock suppliers and the entire value chain all the way through to the end consumer. We also have oil and gas companies as our members. So our Canadian polite conciliatory approach is absolutely the way forward. It's our view, as our association changes into what I will call more of a bioeconomy-driven association, that the primary driver for us is going to be climate change, and it's going to be the effectiveness of the products that our members create at reducing the releases of anthropogenic gases to ward off future climate catastrophe. And that should be the key primary driver for the growth of our sector is the ability to monetize that carbon differential.
Joel Velasco, I'm here as a senior advisor to the board of UNICA, Brazilian Sugarcane Industry Association. I spent a few years in the past representing full-time UNICA. Know a little bit about bringing down barriers to trade and to use of fuels, and look forward to talking about that. My day job is currently at Amyris, an advanced renewable fuels and chemicals company out of California. But I'm focused here on talking about ethanol. I think Brazil has shown that we can use ethanol, not just at higher blends, but pure, that trade is good for both the exporter and the importer, because it ultimately helps the consumer. And I think that's the role Brazil is trying to play in the biofuels arena, and I hope we continue to do that, and maybe get a few people to learn how to do that.
Great, thanks, Joel. We got a bunch of issues here I want to touch on, but I'm glad we have somebody here who understands and knows the Indian market very well, because one of the things that always struck me is that about India and South Asia is that there's tremendous potential there to grow a robust biofuels industry. Particularly India, with the abundance of sugarcane, great climate. They're a huge energy importer, so there's clearly a need to grow their local fuel supply. Maybe, Jayant, if you can explain to me, I'm a little bit mystified at India and why it hasn't taken off, and maybe I see Brazil as a great model for what India could be, but there seems to be something that's preventing India from growing rapidly. Maybe if you can shed some light on that for us, be great to hear.
Yeah, as you rightly said, India could be a great market for ethanol and other biofuels. And it is although our company is from India, it is very, very surprising that Indian program has not really developed so well. Although we as a company, we have developed very well and we are present globally. There are several reasons for that. India imports almost 60% of its oil. Although we have enough refining capacity, we need to import almost 60% of the crude oil, and which is the biggest foreign exchange outgo for India. There are a number of reasons. One of them is the sugar industry in India is not fully liberalized like you have in case of Brazil. So we have central government's rules and regulations. We had a special subsidy sugar which was to be sold to poor people, and which that program was not working very well, so they recently disbanded that. Slowly, Indian sugar industry is getting liberalized. So Indian sugar mills, which were earlier only 2,000, 5,000 tons, now they are going to 10,000 tons, 15,000 tons. So it has been a long process. Earlier, there was a program of 5% blending. It was more of a ministry diktat rather than a mandate. But now 5% mandate has been signed, and it is being implemented. Currently, it is being the oil companies are buying the ethanol, and it is not a full free trade so far. And our company has made special efforts to convince the oil industry that they can still make the same amount of money. So we are doing that, and it has been a long process. Indian government has a long-term vision to go to 10% E10 blend. There was another problem was India has a very large potable alcohol industry, beverage-grade alcohol industry, and India also has a very large ethanol or alcohol-based chemical industry. And all these sectors were against ethanol. So the same thing was going on in India, and now we are at a situation where E5 is fully in place. And we've seen that in the last 5 years, number of beverage-grade plants, neutral spirit plants based on grains such as corn or sorghum or millet, etc., have come up, which is liberating the alcohol or industrial alcohol for ethanol purpose. So there are several reasons, but I think the multitude of taxes between the federal or central government and the state government, these have been one of the biggest impediments for the growth of ethanol industry. And the process has already started. I expect that by 2015, the E5 program will be fully in place, and then we'll move from there.
Great. Thanks, Jan. Let me switch gears for a second here and talk about a little bit of a sensitive issue. And at the risk of offending some of our friends in the oil industry, I want to address an issue about our industry's relationship with the oil industry. And as you all know, this is a very complicated relationship we have with the oil industry. Downstream, these folks are our customers at the end of the day. But there's been, as we all know, a very stressed relationship over the years. And I've been in this business for 12 or 13 years. And it has gone through various forms over the last decade or so, and we've had some big wins with mandates across various jurisdictions, and I would say the last few years we've tried to maintain a civil relationship and tried to have a professional dialogue and whatnot with the oil industry. But you know, I'm probably going to be less diplomatic than these guys will, but you know, I've heard some things in the last few weeks that have just made my skin crawl about how the oil industry has spent millions of dollars trying to snuff out our industry, and everything from sophisticated campaigns and robocalls and all kinds of things on the EPA proposal, but not just in the U.S., elsewhere, and funding studies, research, opposition to our industry that is just that we should not take lying down. So I would like to hear from you guys your thoughts on the relationship with the oil industry. Again, I'm less diplomatic than you guys probably will be, because I just think this is not going to ever end. We have this relationship that's always going to be in conflict, and as such, we should conduct ourselves as if we are in this conflict, and behave accordingly. So let me throw it out to you guys, and any one of you. I mean, it's a very complicated relationship, because they're our customers, but at the end of the day, I see it with my eyes open. They want us gone, period. And that may not trickle down to the retail level, but at high levels, they would be quite happy to see us disappear. So I don't know what, maybe Joel, you want to?
Bliss, I'll say, I mean, it's clearly a complicated relationship. I wouldn't say they want us gone. I mean, I'd say, give you an example. Shell is the half joint venture partner of Brazil's largest ethanol industry. There are some oil companies that may be more, let's say, anti-ethanol or anti-biofuels, but it's not always going to be like that. I think the real issue is really sometimes policies and that distort the marketplace. And the oil industry, especially where we've got state-owned oil players in the case of Brazil, for policy reasons, really affect the market. I mean, Brazil is today importing significant quantities of refined products, largely at the behest of the government, who's trying to keep gasoline prices low, and they haven't built enough refinery capacity in Brazil. So if you take sort of data from the last few years, it's somewhere between half to a quarter of $1 billion every month Brazil is losing via its oil company to bring in petroleum products into the country. This is a country that has been and can continue to be self-sufficient. That policy is wrong not just for the ethanol industry in Brazil or globally. It's wrong.
But let me challenge that for a second, Joel, because, you know, without those so-called market-distorting policies, would the oil industry voluntarily start blending biofuels? I don't think
so.
Yes,
they would. Here's why.
Okay, all right.
I'll take it on. Our mandate in Canada is 5. They blend at 10. And if you think they hate ethanol, they really hate biodiesel. And that has to do with the chemistry of the fuel. I don't like to monolithically paint an industry with one brush. I think there, as Shell is a good example, we have members of the oil and gas sector on our board. They see the value in the product. And it's not just the price. It's not just the octane. There are other values that this product that we create for the fuel market that can be demonstrated. Now, that isn't to say that there aren't fierce opponents of our industry. And there are. But of all the death threats I've received, they've only come from the renewable diesel sector. It's never been from oil and gas. So we'll leave it at that.
I never got.
Bob, I know you want to weigh in on this. You're on the front lines of a pretty nasty
fight. I've
been
doing this for a long time, 27 years, and I've seen times when the ethanol industry has been working great with our customers from the refining industry. In fact, I'll remind people that in 2005, when the very first RFS was passed, it was passed through a coalition that included agriculture and oil. The president of the API at the time was here at this conference and talked glowingly about how they supported the RFS because it was going to give them a rational pathway out of MTBE, which they hated even more than ethanol. Now, they weren't wildly enthusiastic about the 2007 bill, where we took a 7.5 billion gallon requirement and made it into a 36 billion gallon requirement. They opposed it. And it was a different coalition with environmentalists and agriculture that got that bill passed. They are our customers at the end of the day. I do not revel in the rhetorical flair that we all tend to take on both sides of this issue. But this is a serious battle. They are trying to protect market share. We're trying to take it. So it is a natural consequence of that economic reality. And it is something that we're all facing. It's probably more complicated for Joel than anybody because it's a state-owned industry there. So they talk about schizophrenia with the government that wants to build an ethanol industry at the same time that, you know, they're controlling the supply and the price of oil. But with us, it's equally complicated. But like Scott, there are companies that will blend more. I think, look, Marathon today, they don't like the policy, but they do like ethanol. And there's an economic incentive for them to do it. Now, how much would they blend? Would they blend 15 billion gallons, 20 billion gallons, 30 billion gallons of ethanol? Probably not. In fact, they would like to use ethanol to keep ethanol in its octane box. And we'll blend it up to 10% because it helps us meet Clean Air Act requirements and it helps us meet our octane needs. But I think we can do more than that with renewables. There are important public policy reasons that we should be doing more than that, whether it's carbon or rural economic development or energy security. And those policy priorities don't necessarily match up with the economic direction that the shareholders of ExxonMobil want to go. So we're going to struggle. But we do need to recognize they're our customers.
Yeah, I think, Bob, you summed it up best when you said we're trying to take market share from probably the largest and most powerful industry on the planet, and they don't want to give it up. So, I mean, I don't think that dynamic's ever going to change.
But let's not be so pessimistic, Blizz. I mean, the U.S. has conquered 10% of that market already. It's on its way to conquer 15. we can do this. I mean, in Brazil, we're discussing now trying to go to from 25% blends to 27.5% blends, which is really sort of the maximum. Will it happen? I don't know. Probably not. But it's doable. And I think that is what we've got to aim for. It's an incremental step. It's not going to be won. The battle's not going to be won just in one big swoop, or they're going to simply cave. At the same time, we've got to focus on a quality product and the benefits of that product, and make sure that, you know, it's in some instances, you know, ethanol has not performed as well as it should for, say, certain types of transport, and the oil industry is still working on that. I think the biodiesel example, that's a situation we don't want to get into, and I think that is one of the concerns I have is, you know, if we let the brand become a four-letter word here.
Yeah. Can we back up just a second? Because Jill said something that was extraordinarily interesting. Brazil is contemplating going to a 27.5% blend.
Sure.
Are you going to stop mowing your lawns?
No.
You're not going to whack your weeds? You're not going to
get your boats? You're not going to get me to say about the chainsaws.
How in the world are you going to be able to make this conversion?
Well,
that's startling.
What conversion, right? Obviously, we work with the automakers, and we'll try to see, you know, if they can agree to that. Let's remember that most of the cars in Brazil are flex fuel now, and that is something. Brazil has a much smaller auto fleet than the United States, but has a significant percentage of that auto fleet as flex fuel. So those cars actually, hopefully, will never really see much gasoline. Of course, they are using gasoline now because the government, back to the policy driver, are getting in the middle of it. But the 27.5%, I actually think if it came down to it and the product were available and at a good cost, the consumer would demand it. And he would put more than 25%. And that's one of the things we've got to do, you know, crack this wall here.
Let's switch gears for a second here to an issue where we don't all agree, and that's on trade issues. There are always trade tensions between jurisdictions on any given sector, and ethanol is no different. It's, I think, a sign of our maturity. We're growing up, and there's lots of markets at stake, et cetera. Rob, you recently launched a trade action against the United States, which resulted in a new tariff being imposed on U.S. ethanol imports. You know, maybe you can give us, as best you can, an explanation for why you took the trade action. And then, Bob, don't worry, you'll get a chance to respond. But I also want to play this out a little bit. I mean, we've talked about this issue before on this panel, but I'd like to play it out a little bit after your introductory thoughts on this issue, but play it out to the end and see where does this all end if we play out the trade action. Where is this going? Who's going to be the winner? Who's the losers? Beside the lawyers, who's going to win in all this? So maybe, Rob, you can explain your trade action.
I did that already last year, but I'm happy to explain it once more. First of all, when Bob this morning in his very good speech, I must admit, except on the part of Europe, there he was wrong, he said that the consumer is losing out here because they don't have access to cheap American ethanol. Well, Bob, please wake up. I mean, if you would export your ethanol to Europe, who is going to gain? Not the consumer, it's the oil company. The oil company is taking all the margin on it. That is the reality. It's big oil that is claiming all the profit here. Yeah, you guys look disturbed, but
that's 101, I guess.
That's the reality.
Suspend this belief.
I think that explains Europe's economics.
The consumer will not benefit from this. And we have ample proof to demonstrate that. Now, why did we start this case, or we asked the Commission and the Member States to look at it? Because we had clear evidence of dumping. And at that time, there was a subsidy that was taken away, but still the dumping was there. And this has been recognized by, at that time, the 27 member states. And so an anti-dumping duty was introduced. And here it is about fair trade. I mean, we are not against trade, but if you start dumping a product, we have instruments at our, let's say, our discretion to use, and that has happened. And, of course, it's open to the RFA and Growth Energy and all the producers here around the table to say, we don't agree, and we go to court, and that's what you've done. So we will see what's going to happen in the court. We will see each other there maybe soon.
I'll summarize for Rob. He's never met a gallon or liter or hectoliter of ethanol imports that he likes. If it doesn't come from his members, he's against it. He'll find some way to criticize it. And now apparently we're making money off of the big oil. Yeah, the big oil's making money by selling our product.
Listen. We import a lot of product. I don't know how much percentage of your market is imported product, but in our case, it's 20-25% of the market. You don't hit that number, do you? So we're in the same
place. So I wouldn't, because I believe in free and fair trade and open market access for all of our products. But I'm interested in Bob's response. But colored into that response are the nascent free trade negotiations between Europe and the United States. I don't understand how, and I really want to hear Bob's position on this, I don't understand how your position will continue to be tenable, Rob, when you're going to have a dispute resolution mechanism that will basically make it impossible for these types of snap back tariffs to be put on.
Well, I just want to correct one thing that Rob said, and that was that there was evidence of dumping having been found. There was no dumping that was found. The EU came over and they did a forensic audit of 7 ethanol plants and marketers and found not one scintilla of evidence that there had been dumping. The fact of the matter is, U.S. ethanol is able to be produced far lower than European ethanol is able to be produced. You have not been able to meet your own demand. That's why you've needed to have imports, whether it's from Brazil or Canada or the United States. No, Rob, you have not been able to meet your own demand, so there's been a market that was created. What you've tried to do is increase the price of imports so that it gives your guys a bit of an advantage, and absolutely the only ones that are hurt are the consumers, and the only ones that it benefits is the lawyers. At the end, Bliss said he wanted to play this out in a bit. In the end, that tariff is going to come down. It will. And you will have bought yourself a year of, you know, more expensive ethanol coming in, but in the end, the way the world works, we're going to have fair trade. And I do not understand how Europe, on the threshold of major negotiations on a trade agreement, thinks that this is the smart way to begin that relationship.
And guys, now is the perfect time for me to invite both of you to join the Global Renewable Fuels Alliance. I get this once a month. It's awesome.
So, but Rob, how does this end? Like, where in the process, where do we go next? I know there's a 5-year tariff. Where does this all end?
No, hold on. I mean, even if there is a free trade negotiation ongoing, there are also always products excluded. So there is still the possibility that they will decide to exclude ethanol for a good reason. I mean,
well, Europe wants to exclude all of agriculture, and you know, I understand that coming, you know, with Europe, with all that they subsidize their farmers, and that, you know, whatever. But that's your going in position. We're going to have a free trade agreement, but oh no, not agriculture. That's not going to happen.
I'm not speaking here on behalf of the agriculture.
Example of the U.S. I mean, Bob and I used to have a bit of a fight sometimes, a pissing contest, some folks called, over the tariff. And, you know, we resolved it. And look what happened.
What did I always tell you? Right. I always told you that the tariff was only there not to protect the industry, but to protect the tax incentive, so that we weren't exporting our tax incentive.
Awesome.
And as soon as that tax incentive went away, we didn't fight to keep the tariff in place. We were true to our word, and in fact, the tariff is now gone. We were importing Brazilian ethanol when there was a tariff, the offsetting tariff, because Brazilian ethanol got the same benefit in the tax incentive as U.S. produced ethanol.
Give or take a few cents, but that's okay.
Give or take a few cents, granted. But now, There's lots of trade between us. We export to you sometimes. You export to us sometimes. What's most important is that we're working together to build markets, because I'm sick and tired of all of us trying to cannibalize each other's markets when we need to be focused on opening up China. We need to be focused on Japan. Mexico, wherever. But we need to be building markets for all of us.
Absolutely. And I think, Rob, just a little piece of advice. Yeah. I think what you're doing in Europe is ultimately destroying your own market by creating so many barriers and so much. The consumer, yes, well, you just slapped a dumping charge on him. What are you going to do when finally Brazil becomes a little more competitive again and starts selling?
If you would be dumping product, we would slap
not
you.
Yeah. I just warn you, their definition of dumping is a little strange, okay?
It's just like the
if you bring product in at the price that you produce it, you're somehow dumping.
Let's give,
so be careful.
Against my better judgment, okay, let's give Rob the last word on this subject before we move on.
Well,
Rob.
Just, again, I need to correct you, Bob. I mean, apparently you seem to know my market better than I do. I can tell you, we have a production capacity of 8 billion liters. I don't know how much that is in gallon, but yeah, 8 billion liters. We have a market of 5.5 billion. So we can easily provide
are you
our...
drinking the rest?
No, we are underutilizing our capacity. That's the real story. So I don't like you to shut down plants. I don't like you to shut down plants. But we are shutting down plants.
Yeah? Your economics might be shutting down your plants.
Exactly.
We're not doing it.
Whatever. I mean,
export some of that product.
You have a 30-plus year history of supporting the industry. You too. Well, give us a break, yeah? So
and your
have a market. You have access to our markets under fair conditions. You take 25% of that market, so you should shut up now.
But this is, Rob, this is how silly it's gotten. This is how silly it's gotten.
They really are friends offstage.
But as long as it's my soapbox.
Exactly.
You not only have erected this barrier with this ridiculous 25% anti-dumping duty, you're now saying we can't export to other countries. You're raised objections about exporting to Peru or to Norway.
No.
For crying out loud. You know, where is it safe? Where is it safe for the U.S. to send our product? Just give me a list and we'll just
Brazil?
Move on, I guess.
Brazil?
Brazil, okay.
Let's, like it.
We'll okay, guys, yeah. we're not going to solve this problem here today.
Not a problem. It's his problem.
Yeah. They really are a much more friendly bunch offstage than they are on stage. Let's switch gears for a second here and talk a little bit about the future and biofuels policy. I personally think we're at a bit of a fork in the road when it comes to biofuels policy globally. Mandates have been hugely successful and necessary, and they've done their job in terms of creating a market for our products. But I do think we're at a bit of a fork in the road. You know, we have a couple paths we can go down in terms of promoting the industry's growth from a public policy perspective, one of which is, okay, let's go to E15, or, you know, some of the auto manufacturers might think mid-level blends are the way to go. We've heard today about E85. So increasing mandates from 5 or 10% to higher levels is a policy option that we can pursue. But there's also another pathway that we can choose as the people who try and shape public policy here, which is to promote policies that weigh the benefits of our products based on carbon intensity or a low carbon fuel standard. I mean, there are models out there that have gone that way. California, British Columbia, Ontario, we have a biodiesel mandate about to be introduced that also looks at the fuels based on their carbon intensity and the GHG values that they deliver from a policy perspective. So at a fork in the road, I'd be interested in your comments, everybody on the panel, about which path do we go down? Or do we keep pushing for higher level mandates, or do we, you know, take a hard left and start to promote lower carbon fuels policies, or is it a hybrid? I mean, I throw it out to anyone.
I mean, I think from my perspective, thinking about the ethanol industry, I think the future is going west. It's really going to Asia. And because that, if you look at anybody's projection of the future, that is where growth is. That is where, it's not in Europe, and it's probably not going to be here in the United States to the levels that, to significant levels. And to some extent, I'm not quite sure it's going to be much in Brazil and other places. We'll continue growing, but not at the rates close to Asian. And that is where I think the ethanol industry, the biofuels industry, really needs to focus, because those are huge markets. A very small sliver of it is a lot of gallons. And for all of us, we're going to talk about a market we'd have challenge supplying in the beginning. And I think that is whether, and that's not to say we shouldn't focus on blend wall issues, we shouldn't think of hybrid policies, but I think we need to expand the scope of the countries we focus in, because that is, in my view, where the growth is.
And so, Jayant,
my view is that mandates are necessary, especially in the beginning, at the nascent stage of the industry. Classic example is Thailand. Thailand started with E10, and initially there was no excise duty on the ethanol, and subsequently now it is at par with the gasoline, and now almost all the 91 octane gasoline has been replaced by ethanol. Now there is a differential excise duty for the E20 and E85. There is also some small level of subsidy from the government. So I think government and mandates, they definitely can give a helping hand in the at early stage of the industry before it becomes competitive. So yes, definitely mandates are helpful.
So I agree with Joel. I think looking west or looking east is the way to do it. And I think the oil and gas sector in Canada is certainly doing that as well. So can't beat them, join them. I think, though, that mandates have a useful purpose, and I think it is the nascent stages of the industry. I'm not going to oppose anyone who wants to have higher mandates. I think you're asking for tough fights in some circumstances, and we don't have to make the oil industry arguments for them, but I do really see the value add coming from the reduction in carbon, and that is certainly in Europe something that's very popular. Absolutely, in Canada at some point in the future, that's going to be where the true value for ethanol is. It's going to be the reduction in anthropogenic gases. And all of the other industries in our country are going to be forced to reduce their carbon. So they can either do it a very expensive way by refitting their technology or rebuilding their plants, or they could substitute lower carbon fuels to get the exact same number of carbon molecules out of the atmosphere. And I think the biogenic solution that ethanol provides is one that keeps carbon sequestered under the crust, which is the real problem in terms of the global climate change crisis. So I do see the value on the LCFS.
Another issue that...
I'm somewhat agnostic with respect to what the government policy is, if it's a mandate or an LCFS or tax incentives. I think it's largely dependent on the politics in the country where you're trying to do, but I think it is clear that some government policy to move an intransigent marketplace is going to be necessary. I will say this with respect to the LCFS, and I think this is going to be one area where Rob and I agree, is that you need to make sure that the LCFS or a carbon policy is based on good, sound science. And unfortunately, some of the carbon programs, including the one that Europe is looking at, exaggerates the carbon impact of indirect land use change and has come to the perverse conclusion that so-called food can't be used as a feedstock. And those are programs that ultimately we need to be very, very focused on and not let the sound science be buried by competitive incentives or something.
Actually, that's a good segue to one of the issues I wanted to touch on, not necessarily on the food for fuel debate, but one of the things that will mitigate the impacts of that debate is when next generation biofuels have some big wins. And so I'd be interested to hear from you guys, where are we at with next-gen biofuels? We've had, in any new industry, there's always going to be failures. We've had some high-profile failures, but I know there are some huge success stories out there in the hinterland.
When Brazil takes away a great Canadian story and makes it a Brazilian one, yeah.
Well, just on that point, where are we at with some of the next-gen stories that are coming down the pipeline? Do we see some big wins in the coming years? Any of you jump in?
Well, I mean, I'll say I'm a little
Let me
just point out. I mean, I'm in a company that is in this advanced space. Candidly, I think the economics are going to be much better for non-fuel products for a good while for most. And I think the industry is sort of realizing this. That doesn't mean that, you know, let's remember Brazil was drinking their ethanol for quite a while before they started putting it in their cars. So there's nothing wrong with that. But what I do think is we do need to highlight the successes. I mean, in our case, there's 400 buses in the city of São Paulo running on sugarcane diesel. That's a drop-in fuel that actually performs better than fossil diesel. But much more importantly, it's renewable. And I think as you go around the world, you will find those things. It will be driven in part by policy, but at the end of the day, it's going to be driven by economics. And the larger we can get this market, I think the better it is going to be for everybody.
So, I mean, I don't want to highlight companies specifically, but we have an incredibly innovative company in Canada that is actually turning a municipal solid waste problem into a low-carbon fuel solution. And when these stories take off, you're going to see government dollars that would otherwise be used to send our garbage to Michigan used to invest, and that's not a reference to the Red Wings, use those waste diversion programs to build economic growth in municipalities. And by solving one environmental problem, you're going to be creating wealth, which I think is the best possible story that we can have, in that as part of a collective that are using the planet and living on the planet, we do have that obligation to take care of it for the future.
I don't disagree, and we also have a company in Europe that is doing exactly the same.
Ours is better.
That I don't know. I'm not going for sure.
You're wrong.
The issue here is that we have had lots of used cooking oils in Europe that's biodiesel, and we see that artificially used cooking oil is being created. So we're now getting used cooking oils from all over the world, from China, and that is not the way it should happen. That is really a perverse effect of looking at other potentials of this industry. Food crops are very, very good. And we're walking away from that. And unfortunately, Liz, I need to say that my biggest concern now is maybe not trade, because Joel just said that it will all go to China or Asia. That's good news, also for you, Bob. But my real concern is that in Europe, regulators are moving away from biofuels altogether. So what we see now in Europe is that the legislation that has been extremely successful, the Renewable Energy Directive, we have 5% of biofuels in fossil fuels they're going to abolish. So we are becoming victims of our own success. And that's a sad, sad story. We see that in the transport sector, emissions are still increasing. And the only way to address that easily with biofuels, they're taking away. And that is, for me, a big, big concern. So if the European jurisdiction is going to do that, what will that mean for the rest of the world? Will the rest follow? Will say, well, the Europeans, they're a bit stupid. Well, you know, let them do their act, and we move on.
I can't believe we're almost out of time here, but I wanted to end.
But this is Bob's stage, yeah. So we're set.
So let me, if the five of you can gaze into your crystal ball here, we'll end on a maybe a positive note, but gaze into your crystal ball and make a couple predictions. And the first prediction, if you look forward, and we don't have a lot of time, but if you can give us a quick prediction on what you think the next big issue for our industry might be. I personally think that we're, you know, down the road, we're going to be facing an issue of dealing with water issues and water supply issues down the road. And that could be our new food for fuel issue in the future, but that's just a guess. So if you want to make a quick prediction on what you think our future issues might be, things that we might want to get out in front of today. And then the second prediction, given that we are week two into the Winter Olympics, I'm going to put you all on the spot and make a prediction. I feel bad for Brazil and India. They probably don't even have a team, but you have a bobsled team. That's right.
Yeah.
So make a prediction on who's going to win the ice hockey gold medals, and a prediction on the future issues for the industry. So let's start. Joel, over to you.
U.S. will win.
U.S. will win?
Go ahead.
For sure. And I think the big prediction is actually that come some point this year, EPA will actually, the big news is that EPA will realize that supply is supply and demand is demand, that you can't try to switch one for the other, and will actually come back to more reasonable numbers for this industry in the U.S. I think a grave error was made, and I think hopefully they'll see the light. Certainly after all our comments, I'm still digesting some of them, they'll see the light. And I think that's good news.
So I think the challenge that we will face in 5 to 10 years actually has to do with fuel efficiency. And while the current OEMs are looking at E20, E25, E30 as a way to power smaller engines, I think you're going to see a lot of fuel switching into non-gasoline, non-liquid fuels. And I think that more than anything else will be a challenge to our industry, as the battle for the barrel is now the battle for the plug. And it might not necessarily happen that fast, but there are very strong movements in Canada, at least, to see that type of policy change in the same way that we have mandates. On the moderately more important issue of the hockey gold medal, first of all, there's a reason it's called the miracle on ice. In Canada, when they win the gold medal, it's the guess what happened yesterday, just exactly what you thought would happen more next year. So I do look forward to it. But Bob chided me yesterday on a women's game between Canada and the U.S., and he said that we cheated. And I think it's appropriate to point out...
And hang around Rob a lot.
Yeah, I think it's very appropriate to point out, given your speech this morning, that it was an official who failed to recognize what the stated rule was and ignored the stated rule and substituted their new decision for a perverse outcome in favor of my team as opposed to your team. Does that sound like something going on in Washington
to you? Yeah, sounds like the EPA.
All right, the news here is that Canada has acknowledged that that hockey game was a mistake, and you won with an official's mistake. That's awesome. Thank you.
So, Jayant.
Yeah, I think for talking about India, we feel that the feedstock and water, these will be the major challenges going forward. And our company, I don't have to hide any company. It's our company. We are working on both these fronts, including cellulosic ethanol. We have a demo plant. We have a pilot plant operating for the last 5 years. And the demo plant, which we are building in central India, that is going to be zero discharge. And it will also recycle substantial quantity of water. So I'm sure there are technologies available, including ours, to take care of those challenges going forward.
What about the gold medal?
Well, your question about the...
Who's going to win the gold medal ice hockey at the Winter Olympics?
Well, it is very difficult to say that, but I think the ethanol industry will have its share. Anything more than 20% will be somewhat difficult, but I think up to E20 is possible.
He is on message, boy. Very good. Rob.
Yeah, okay. 2014 is a crucial year. I mean, I hope that the EPA will get its act together, and hopefully, Bob, it will turn out good for you. But it's also for Europe a crucial year because we will have a new European Commission, we will have a new European Parliament. And if we will not be able to find champions in the Commission and in the European Parliament that are going to back biofuels, we're out of business. So this is a crucial year for all of us. Now, ice hockey, what is that? I only can tell you that as far as speed skating is concerned, we the Netherlands, we have 17 medals already. You know, that's a good thing. So if we add all the 28 countries together,
speed skating is done now, so is the Netherlands.
There's a reason the Dutch don't play hockey with those funny skates.
I made my predictions earlier. I really like Joel's comment about EPA recognizing that supply is supply and consumption is consumption, and you can't just flip the two because you're suddenly adopting European economics. And as for the gold, my prediction would be that the U.S. women avenge the travesty that occurred in the preliminary rounds, and they will win the gold medal in the women's hockey. And, of course, I represent the ethanol industry. I believe in miracles.
Yeah. Well, it's going to take a miracle. It's going to take a miracle.
The U.S. men are taking that goal, too.
All right. I get the last word because I'm the moderator. Canada is going to play the U.S. in the semifinals, unfortunately. So it looks like it's going to be a Canada-Russia final, and Canada's going to win in overtime. All right. Thanks very much for staying with us. Thanks, everyone.